is when we do something for ourselves or others, where our sole intention is to enrich life. We're not doing it for a reward. We're not doing it to escape punishment. We're doing it out of what I think we human beings like more than anything in the world, to contribute to life, to enrich life. Nonviolent communication, then, is integration of different things that helps people to connect in this way. First, nonviolent communication is language, language of a sort that helps us to connect with ourselves and others. It's a language of life, a language based on human feelings and human needs. It's a language that helps us to communicate what would make life more wonderful for ourselves. But nonviolent communication is not only language. It also involves strategies for influencing one another. In addition to sharing the process with you, I'd like to share with you some of the ways that I have been making this available to people around the world and their reactions to it. A student was traveling with me as part of an internship from the university. And he went to several countries with me, and he saw the people I was working with, many of them in war-torn countries who were using the training in the service of peace. And about the seventh country that we visited, he looked at me and said, "You are a very rich man." And I feel very blessed to do the work that I'm doing with the people I'm doing and seeing how they make good use out of it. I feel I am a very rich man. I see a different world than you see on the news. I see a world of people who are committed to compassionate giving, who want to create structures that support this compassionate giving. So, in addition to sharing the process itself, I'll be glad to share with you some of the experiences I've had with people around the world who are helping us distribute this process. So now let me give you an overview of what the process itself looks like, this process we call nonviolent communication. As I have said, it is designed to help us to connect so that compassionate giving is natural. So what kind of communication helps us to connect in that way? We can summarize the process by saying it focuses on two questions. What's alive in us, and what would make life more wonderful? What's alive in us is, we say in English this way, how are you? French, comment allez-vous? Spanish, como está usted? Every culture I work in throughout the world, in their own way, when they get together, ask this question. What's alive in you? It's a critical question because I'm convinced that when we are connected on what's alive in each of us and get rid of the enemy images that we have been educated to think in terms of when somebody's doing something we don't like, when we can just see the humanness in each other at any given moment, what's alive in us? It's been my experience that we can resolve any conflict peacefully in a way that gets everyone's needs met. Now, what does this involve to be able to communicate what's alive in us? Well, it requires that we be able to tell people what they're doing that's enriching our lives. And we can bring to their attention when they're doing things that are not enriching our lives. And as we'll see subsequently, it's very important to be clear about this and not mix up our reference to what people are doing with any kind of evaluation that implies wrongness. So it requires observing without evaluating. Another important part of expressing what's alive in us is to speak from the heart, to speak what is going on inside of us in relationship to what is happening outside of us. And the best way I've found of doing this is to develop a literacy and consciousness of feelings and needs. Our needs are life in action. If we're disconnected from our needs, we're not really alive. If we spend all of our time only analyzing and judging mentally and not able to get connected to what is going on inside of us, it's going to be very hard to enjoy life to its fullest. So nonviolent communication focuses on what our needs are in any given moment and whether they're being met or not. Our feelings are connected to our needs. When our needs are being fulfilled, we feel pleasurable feelings. When our needs are not being fulfilled, we have painful feelings. So these three together, telling people what they're doing that's enriching our life or not, and then telling them what's alive in us in relationship to that in terms of our feelings and our needs, that's one of the basic components of the process. Having told people what's alive in us, if what they're doing is not contributing to our well-being, then we need to add, what could make life more wonderful for us? And to present this to them as an opportunity, as a gift, not as a demand or a threat. So nonviolent communication shows us both how to express what's alive in us and what would make life more wonderful. And it shows us how to receive that information empathically from others, how to receive it even if the other person is not articulate in expressing it. So no matter how the other person is communicating, nonviolent communication shows us how to connect with that person's humanity at any given moment. So what is the cause of our anger? I earlier suggested several options we have when confronted with a message or behavior that we don't like. Anger is generated when we choose the option of finding fault, blaming the other person. Anger tells us that at that moment we are choosing to play a game I call punitive God. We are sitting in judgment of what another person has done and blaming the other person as being wrong or deserving of punishment. That's the cause of anger, this kind of thinking. Even if we're not initially conscious of it, it's this kind of thinking that causes our anger. Another way we could respond to behavior we don't like is to shine the light of consciousness on our own feelings and needs. Rather than going up to our head to make a mental analysis of wrongness of the other person, we could choose to connect to the life that is within us. This life energy is most palpable and accessible when we focus on what we need in each moment. For example, if someone arrives late for an appointment and we need reassurance that the person cares about us, we may feel hurt. If instead our need is to spend time purposely and constructively, we may feel frustrated. If, on the other hand, our need is for 30 minutes of quiet solitude, we may be grateful for the person's tardiness. We might feel pleased. Thus, it's not the behavior of the other person, but our own need that causes our feelings. When we are connected to our need, whether it is for reassurance, purposefulness, or solitude, we are in touch with our life energy. We may have strong feelings, but we're never angry. Anger is a result of life-alienated thinking that is disconnected from needs. It indicates that we have moved up to our head to analyze and judge somebody, rather than focus on which of our needs is not being met. In addition to the option of focusing on our own feelings and needs, we have another choice at any moment, and that is to shine the light of our consciousness on the other person's feelings and needs. When we choose this option, we also never feel anger. We are not repressing the anger. Rather, we see how anger is simply absent in each moment that we are fully present with the other person's feelings and needs, or our feelings and needs. Sometimes I'm asked, aren't there circumstances in which anger is justified? Isn't righteous indignation called for in the face of careless, thoughtless pollution of the environment, for example? My answer is that I strongly believe that to whatever degree I support the consciousness that there is such a thing as a careless action or a conscientious action, a greedy person or a moral person, I believe in some way I'm really contributing to violence on this planet. Rather than agreeing or disagreeing about what people are for murdering, raping, or polluting the environment, I believe we serve life better by focusing attention on whether or not our needs are being met by such behavior. I see all anger as a result of life-alienating, violence-provocative thinking. That's the cause of the anger. I think at the root of all anger is a need that's not being fulfilled. Thus, anger can be valuable if we use it as an alarm clock to wake us up, to realize we have a need that isn't being met, and that we're thinking in a way that makes it unlikely that the need will be met. So to fully express anger, I would suggest that we need to be fully conscious of our need. In addition, energy is required to get the need met. Anger, however, co-opts our energy by directing it toward punishing people rather than directing the energy to meeting our needs. Instead of engaging in righteous indignation, I recommend connecting empathically with our own needs and those of others. This may take extensive practice whereby, over and over again, we consciously replace the phrase, "I'm angry because they did what they did," with, "I'm angry because I'm needing," and we get in touch with what we're needing. I once was taught a remarkable lesson about anger while working with students in a correctional school in Wisconsin. On two successive days, I was hit in the nose while I was trying to stop a fight between two young men. The first time I received a sharp blow across the nose from an elbow while I was breaking up the fight. I was so enraged it was all I could do to keep myself from hitting the child. On the streets of Detroit where I grew up, it took far less than an elbow in the nose to provoke me to rage. The second day, a very amazing similar situation. I got hit in the same nose while breaking up a fight, and thus I had more physical pain than the day before, but I wasn't a bit angry. Reflecting deeply that evening on this experience, I recognized I had labeled the first child in my mind as a spoiled brat. That image was in my head before his elbow ever caught my nose, and when it did hit my nose, it was no longer simply an elbow hitting my nose. It was, "That obnoxious brat has no right to do this." That judgment flew into my head so rapidly I wasn't even aware of it at the time. I had a different judgment about the second child. I saw that child as a pathetic creature. Since I had a tendency to worry about this child, even though my nose was hurting and bleeding more severely the second day, I felt no rage at all. I could not have received a more powerful lesson to help me see that it's not what other people do, but the images and interpretations in our heads that produces our anger. Now, there are many different ways that I hope I can show you how this process of nonviolent communication can be applied. We can apply it within ourselves. And I'll show you shortly how we can use it to learn from our limitations without losing self-respect. It can help us to connect with the people that we're the closest with, our children, our partners, and our work situations. But I'll also show you its application in resolving disputes between people that might be doing things in a way we don't like. We can use it to alter the structures that we're living within and to transform them into structures that support compassionate giving. Let me give you an idea of how some of the people use it and what they say about it. Here's what someone who'd been in a workshop with me in San Diego had to say about it. And I'm quoting, "When I learned how I can receive as well as give through using nonviolent communication, I went beyond interpreting that I was being attacked and becoming a doormat to really listening to words and extracting the underlying feelings of the speaker. I discovered a very hurting man to whom I had been married for 28 years. He had asked me for a divorce the weekend before I came to the nonviolent communication workshop. To make a long story short, we're here today together, and I appreciate the contribution that nonviolent communication made to our happy ending. I learned to listen for feelings, to express my needs, to accept answers that I didn't always want to hear. I saw that he's not here to make me happy, nor am I here to create happiness for him. No, you can't make people feel as they do. We've learned that by just connecting in a certain way, a love develops between us so that we can meet each other's needs and the happiness just happens. I learned that we can't be responsible for each other's feelings, but we can be responsible for how we react to one another. And if we connect with this kind of consciousness, we'll end up both getting our needs met, and the happiness flows from that." Here's what a doctor told me who lives in Paris, France, about how she uses the training. "I use nonviolent communication more and more in my medical practice. Some patients ask me whether I'm a psychologist, saying that usually their doctors are not interested in the way they live their lives or deal with their diseases. Nonviolent communication helps me understand what the patient's needs are and what they need to hear at a given moment. I find this particularly helpful in relating to patients with hemophilia and AIDS, because there's so much anger and pain that the patient-healthcare provider relationship is often seriously impaired. Still others are using our process of nonviolent communication in the political arena. A French cabinet member visiting her sister remarked how differently the sister and her husband were communicating and responding to each other. Encouraged by their descriptions of nonviolent communication, she mentioned that she was scheduled the following week to negotiate some sensitive issues between France and Algeria regarding adoption procedures. Though time was limited, we dispatched a French-speaking trainer to Paris to work with the cabinet minister. She later attributed much of the success of her negotiations in Algeria to her newly acquired communication techniques. Worldwide, nonviolent communication now serves as a valuable resource for communities facing violent conflicts and severe ethnic, religious, or political tensions. The spread of nonviolent communication and its use in mediation by people in conflict in Israel, the Palestinian Authority, Nigeria, Rwanda, Sierra Leone, and elsewhere have been a source of particular gratification for me. My associates and I were once working with Serbians and Croatians during the war there. I brought them to a neutral country for doing this work. The first few days, enormously painful, to help them to get past the enemy images and see the humanness in one another. How wonderful, as the training progressed, to hear progressive rings of laughter in their voices, as they shared their profound gratitude and joy for having seen how nonviolent communication could translate their enemy images of the other side and help them see the humanness of each other. And I'm pleased to see what these people have done with the training since in their countries in helping the people to get past the kind of thinking that leads us to see enemies. I feel blessed to be able to travel throughout the world teaching people this process of communication and seeing them empowered in the ways that they are. And now I'm pleased to be able to share this with you. Before getting into describing some of the mechanics in greater detail for you, in a way that I hope will help you to integrate the mechanics into your life, I'd like to first identify some communication that unfortunately many of us have been taught that I think blocks compassion, that blocks the connection necessary for us to connect with others in a way in which everybody's needs can get met. One of the most destructive kinds of communication that I was taught and that I see other people being taught is how to evaluate one another using moralistic judgments that basically focus on rightness and wrongness. Now, when I question these kind of judgments, people often think I'm talking about not having any judgments at all. What I hope to show is that I do recognize that we need to judge, but there's a radically different way of judging than going up to our head and judging people as right, wrong, good, bad, normal, abnormal, stupid or intelligent, attractive or ugly. Nonviolent communication suggests evaluating with a language of life, not a language in which we sit in judgment of one another. So, nonviolent communication judges, but judges from a standpoint of, is this behavior serving life or not? It doesn't judge from a position of whether this other person deserves to be rewarded or punished. We've probably all found ourselves in the midst of lifeless conversation. Perhaps we're at a social event hearing words without feeling any connection to the speaker. Or we may be listening to a Babylonian, a term my friend Kelly Bryson uses to describe people who talk on and on and on. In fact, he says they belong to a self-help group called On and On Anonymous. Vitality drains out of conversations when we lose connection with the feelings and needs generating a speaker's words. This is common when people talk without consciousness of what they're really feeling, needing, or requesting. Instead of being engaged in an exchange of life energy with other human beings, it's easy to experience ourselves as simply wastebaskets for the other person's words. So I think it's real important to know how and when to interrupt a dead conversation to bring it back to life. I suggest the best time to interrupt is when we've heard one word more than we want to hear. The longer we wait, the harder it is to be civil when we do say something. But it's also important that our intention in stopping another person is not to claim the floor for ourselves, but to help the speaker connect with what's alive in them and to connect with what they're really wanting. I do this by tuning into the possible feelings and needs the person has at this moment, even if the feelings and needs are not being expressed through the person's words. Thus, if an aunt is repeating the story about how 20 years ago her husband deserted her with two small children, we might interrupt by saying, "So, Auntie, sounds like you're still feeling hurt and wishing you need for fairness had been met." People are not aware that it is often empathy they are needing, and they don't realize that when they do need empathy, telling the story of what happened in the past is not as likely to get them the empathy as if they talk now about what's still alive in them about that. Another way to bring a conversation to life is to openly express our desire to be more connected and to request information that would help us establish that connection. Once at a cocktail party, I was in the midst of an abundant flow of words that to me, however, seemed lifeless. "Excuse me," I broke in, addressing the group of nine other people I found myself with. "I'm feeling impatient because I really have a need for connection with you all, but our conversation isn't creating the kind of connection I'd like. I'd like each of you to tell me if the conversation we're having is meeting your needs, and if so, what needs of yours are being met through it." All nine people stared at me as if I had thrown a rat in the punch bowl. Fortunately, I remembered to tune into the feelings and needs being expressed through their silence. And I empathically reflected, "Are you all feeling annoyed with what I said and needing to to continue the conversation? They all continued to look at me for a short time, and one of the men replied, No, I'm not annoyed. I was thinking about what you're asking. No, I wasn't enjoying the conversation. In fact, to tell you the truth, I was totally bored with it. At the time, I was surprised to hear his response, because he was the one that was doing most of the talking. But now I'm no longer surprised that the talker can be as bored as anyone else, because I've learned that when conversations are lifeless, the speaker is often not getting what they want any more than anybody else. You may wonder how we can muster the courage to intervene in this way to bring a conversation back to life. I once conducted an informal survey posing the following question. If you are using more words than somebody wants to hear, do you want that person to pretend to listen or to stop you? Of the people I asked this, all but one expressed a preference to be stopped. Their answers gave me courage by convincing me that it's more considerate to interrupt people than to pretend to listen. All of us would like our words to enrich others, not to burden them. One of the hardest messages for many of us to empathize with is silence. This is especially true when we've expressed ourselves vulnerably, and we really need to know how others are reacting to our words. At such times, it's easy to project our worst fears onto the lack of response and forget to connect with the feelings and needs being expressed through the silence. Once when I was working in a business organization, I got in touch with some deep feelings and expressed them, and I started to cry. When I looked up, I received a response from the organization's director that was not easy for me to receive empathically. He was silent, and the look on his face was easy for me to interpret that he was feeling disgusted with me for being so emotional. Fortunately, I remembered to put my attention on what might be going on within him to try to connect with his feelings and needs. And I said, I'm sensing from your response to my crying that you're feeling disgusted, and my crying doesn't meet your need to have someone in control of himself. If he had answered yes, I would have been able to accept that. We had different values around expressing emotions, without somehow thinking that I was wrong for having expressed my emotions as I did. But he didn't say yes. He replied, No, no, not at all. I was just thinking of how my wife wishes I could cry. He went on to reveal that his wife, who was in the process of divorcing him, had been complaining that living with him was like living with a rock. In our development toward a state of emotional liberation, most of us seem to experience three stages in the way we relate to others and their needs. In one stage, which I refer to as emotional slavery, we believe that we're responsible for the feelings of others. We think it's our job to make everybody happy, and if they're not happy, we feel responsible and compelled to do something about it. This can easily lead us to see the very people who are closest to us as real burdens. Taking responsibility for the feelings of others can be very detrimental in intimate relationships. I regularly hear people tell me that they're frightened of intimate relationships because of this. They say things like, every time I see my partner in pain or needing something, I feel overwhelmed. I feel like I'm in prison, that I'm being smothered, and I just have to get out of the relationship as fast as possible. This response is common among those who experience love as denial of one's own needs in order to attend the needs of the other. In the early days of a relationship, partners typically relate joyfully and compassionately to each other out of a sense of freedom. The relationship is exhilarating, spontaneous, wonderful. Eventually, however, as they define the relationship as serious, now the partners start to assume responsibility for each other's feelings, and from then on, things can go downhill very fast. If I were a partner who's conscious of doing this, I could improve the situation by acknowledging it and saying, it's hard for me to see your pain. As soon as I see it, I lose connection with myself. Unfortunately, most people haven't reached the level of awareness that they can bring that out into the open like that, and instead they often blame their partners. They say, you're too needy, you're too dependent. When we do that, it makes the situation worse very quickly. At another level, another stage, we become aware of the high cost of assuming responsibility for other people's feelings and trying to accommodate them at our own expense. When we notice how much of our lives we've missed and how little we've responded to the call of our own soul, we may get angry. I refer jokingly to this stage as the obnoxious stage, because now, instead of taking responsibility for other people's feelings, denying our needs, doing for them, and then later feeling resentful, now we say, that's your problem. I'm not responsible for your feelings. In this stage, we're clear what we are not responsible for. We no longer want to think that we're responsible for the other person's happiness. We don't want to be always having to deny ourselves and do for them. Unfortunately, we're not quite clear yet about this idea of responsibility, what we do want to assume responsibility for. So when we're only in this phase, we often rebel against the other person's feelings in a way that's not good for us or them. As we emerge from this stage of emotional enslavement, we may continue to carry remnants of fear and guilt around having our own needs. Thus, it's not surprising that we end up expressing our needs in a way that sound rigid and unyielding to the ears of others. For example, during a break in one of my workshops, a young woman expressed appreciation for the insight she'd gained into her own state of emotional enslavement. When the workshop resumed, I suggested an activity to the group. The same young woman then declared assertively, "I'd rather do something else." I sensed she was exercising her newfound right to express her needs, even if they ran counter to those of others. To encourage her to sort out what her needs really were, I said, "Do you want to do something else, even if it conflicts with my needs?" She thought for a moment and then stammered, "Yes. No." Her confusion reflects how, in this second stage, we have yet to grasp that emotional liberation entails more than simply asserting our own needs. It requires asserting our own needs, to be sure, but in a way that communicates that we are equally interested in the needs of others. I recall an incident during my daughter's passage toward emotional liberation. She'd always been the perfect little girl who denied her own needs to comply with the wishes of others. When I became aware of how frequently she suppressed her own desires in order to please others, I started to talk to her about this and told her I'd enjoy hearing her needs. When we first broached the subject, she said, "But Daddy, I don't want to disappoint anybody." I helped her to see how her honesty would be a precious gift and not a burden. I also suggested she could empathize with people when they are upset without taking responsibility for their feelings. A short time later, I saw evidence that my daughter was beginning to listen to what I said and try to integrate it into her life and express herself more openly. A call came from her school principal, apparently disturbed by a communication he'd had with Marla. When I went in to talk to the school administrator, he said, "Marla came to school today dressed in blue jeans. I told her that isn't how young ladies dress. And she said, 'Bug off.'" Well, I was thrilled. Marla had started to liberate herself and started to listen to her own needs and not feel that she always had to please others. Yes, I could see that I hadn't made clear how to express our needs in a way that shows also respect and understanding of others, but I knew that would come. And so I was celebrating, but it was a little hard for me to get the school administrator to celebrate. So when we reach a third stage of what I call emotional liberation, whenever we do respond to the needs of others, we do so out of compassion, never out of fear, guilt, or shame. We make sure that we don't suppress our own needs in responding to the needs of others. Therefore, when we do what others want, it's fulfilling to us. We also have the consciousness that it's a gift to other people to hear our needs. And so we express our needs with the Santa Claus energy that I mentioned earlier. So emotional liberation involves stating clearly what we need in a way that communicates we're equally concerned with the needs of others as well as our own. Nonviolent communication is designed to connect us in this way, that everybody's needs get met. I emphasize the distinction between cause and stimulus on practical and tactical, as well as on philosophical grounds. I'd like to illustrate this point by returning to the dialogue I referred to earlier with John, that prisoner in Sweden. As you recall, John said, 3 weeks ago I made a request to the prison officials, and they still haven't responded to my request. And then I asked John, so when this happened, you felt angry because what? What was going on in you that made you angry? John, I just told you they didn't respond to my request. I said, hold it. Instead of saying I felt angry because they, stop and become conscious of what you're telling yourself that's making you so angry. John said, I'm not telling myself anything. And I said, hey, John, slow down. Stop. Just listen to what's going on inside yourself. John stopped and reflected for a few moments, and then he said, well, I'm telling myself that they have no respect for human beings. They're a bunch of cold, faceless bureaucrats who don't give a damn about anybody but themselves. They're a bunch of... And I interrupted him. I said, hold it. That's enough. That's enough. Look at all that's going on in you. That's why you're angry. You have that thinking going on. He said, well, what's wrong with thinking that way? I said, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with thinking that way. Notice I'm just trying to say that it's this thinking that is causing you to be angry. I'm not saying you shouldn't judge people. You shouldn't think in this way. If I did, I'd be doing the very thing. No, all I want you to do is see that when you see people that way and think about them that way, it's that thinking on your part that makes you angry. Now I'd like you to try something else. Now look for your needs that are being expressed through that message. You see, remember what I told you earlier, John. All of the judgments that make us angry are really expressions of needs. The needs are at the root of this. A need of yours isn't getting met. So focus on your need that wasn't met by their action. John deliberated about this for quite a long while, and then he said, Marshall, I need the training I'm requesting. If I don't get that training, just as sure as I'm sitting here, I'm going to end up back in this prison when I get out. I said, now, John, now that your attention is on your needs, how are you feeling right now? He said, scared. I said, okay, now put yourself in the shoes of a prison official. Pretend like I'm an inmate. Am I more likely to get my needs met if I come to you saying, hey, I really need that training, and I'm scared of what's going to happen if I don't get it? Or if I approach while seeing you as a faceless bureaucrat? Even if I don't say those words out loud, my eyes will reveal that kind of thinking is going on in me. Which way am I more likely to get my needs met? John sat staring at the floor, silent. I said, hey, buddy, what's going on? John said, I can't talk about it right now. 3 hours later, John approached me and said, Marshall, I wish you had taught me 2 years ago what you taught me this morning about anger. I wouldn't have had to kill my best friend. All violence, I believe, is the result of people tricking themselves, as did this young prisoner, into believing that their pain derives from other people and that those people deserve to be punished for what they did. One time I saw my younger son take a 50-cent piece from his sister's room. I said, Brett, did you ask your sister whether you could have that? He answered, I didn't take anything from her. Now, I had several options. I could call him a liar, which would, however, have worked against my getting my needs met, since any judgment of another person diminishes the likelihood of our needs being met. Where I focused my attention at this moment was critical. If I were to judge him as lying, it would point me in one direction. If I were to interpret that he didn't respect me enough to tell the truth, I would be pointed in another direction. If, however, I were either to empathize with him at that moment or express nakedly what I was feeling and needing, I would greatly increase the possibility of getting my needs met. The way I expressed my choice, which in this situation turned out helpful, was not through what I said, but through what I did. Instead of judging him as lying, I tried to hear his feelings. I guessed he was scared, and his need was to protect himself against being punished. By empathizing with him, I had the chance of making an emotional connection out of which we both get our needs met. However, if I had approached him with the view that he was lying, even if I hadn't expressed it out loud, he would have been less likely to feel safe expressing truthfully what had happened. If I had judged him as a liar, that very act of judging him, whether I said it out loud, would make it very hard for him to respond. People can tell when they're being judged by our nonverbal behavior as well as our verbal behavior. And then, if I judge a person as a liar, why would that person want to tell the truth? And why would anyone want to be truthful with somebody who judges and punishes? I would like to suggest that when our heads are filled with judgments and analyses that others are bad, greedy, irresponsible, lying, cheating, valuing profit more than life, or behaving in other ways they shouldn't, that we think they shouldn't, very few of them will be interested in our needs. If we want to protect the environment, and we go to a corporate executive with the attitude, "You know, you really are a killer of the planet. You have no right to abuse the land in this way." Even before we've said a word, I think we have severely impaired our chances of getting our needs met. We're not likely to find many human beings who can maintain focus on our needs when we are expressing them through images of their wrongness. Of course, we may be successful in using such judgments to intimidate people into meeting our needs. If they feel so frightened, guilty, or ashamed that they change their behavior, we may come to believe that it's possible to win by telling people what's wrong with them. With a broader perspective, however, we realize that each time our needs are met in this way, we not only lose, but we have contributed very tangibly to violence on the planet. We may have solved an immediate problem, but we will have created another one. The more people hear blame and punishment, the more defensive and aggressive they become, and the less they will care about our needs in the future. So even if our present need is met, in the sense that people do what we want, we will pay for it later. The Sufi poet Rumi once wrote, "Out beyond ideas of right and wrongdoing, there is a field. I'll meet you there." It's in that place that nonviolent communication helps us to live. It's quite a different world than this world of right-doing and wrong-doing, in which we decide whether the person deserves to suffer or deserves to be rewarded. In the world that Rumi is talking about, we see that compassionate giving is what is our nature and which is the most fulfilling way for us to live. Long before I reached adulthood, I had already learned to communicate in the impersonal moralistic judgments. These do not require us to reveal what's alive in us. They simply require us to judge people. When I encountered people or behavior I either didn't like or didn't understand, I was educated to react in terms of their wrongness. If my teachers assigned a task I didn't want to do, they were mean or unreasonable. If somebody pulled out in front of me in traffic, I might react by thinking or saying, "You idiot." When we speak this language, we think and communicate in terms of what's wrong with others for behaving as they do, or what's wrong with ourselves for behaving as we do. Our attention is focused on classifying, analyzing, and determining levels of wrongness rather than on whether life is being served or not. When I'm communicating in the way I was programmed to communicate, If my life partner wants more affection than I'm giving, she is needy and dependent. But if I want more affection than I'm receiving, she's aloof and insensitive. If my partner is more concerned about details than I am, she's picky and compulsive. On the other hand, if I'm more concerned about details than she is sloppy and disorganized. It's my belief that all such analyses of other human beings are tragic expressions of our own values and needs. They're tragic because when we express our values and needs in this form, we increase defensiveness and resistance to them among the very people who are of concern to us. Or if they do agree to act in harmony with our values, because they are convinced when people respond to our needs, will likely do so out of fear, guilt, or shame. And we pay dearly, I'm convinced, when people respond to our needs, not out of desire to give from their heart, but out of fear, guilt, or shame. Sooner or later, we will experience the consequences of a diminished goodwill on the part of those who comply with our needs out of this sense of worrying about punishment or some kind of guilt inducement. Further, each time others associate us in their minds with guilt or fear or shame, we decrease the likelihood of their responding compassionately to our needs and values in the future. The relationship between language and violence is the subject of psychology professor O.J. Harvey's research at the University of Colorado. He took random samples of pieces of literature from many countries over the world and tabulated the frequency of words that classify and judge people. His study shows a high correlation between the frequent use of such words and incidences of violence. It doesn't surprise me to hear that there is considerably less violence in cultures where people think in terms of human needs than in cultures where people label one another as good or bad, right or wrong, normal or abnormal, and they believe that the bad people deserve to be punished. I feel great pain when I see how many of the programs that children are watching on television in which the heroes, in the course of the program, either kill or beat somebody up. Walter Wink, the theologian, has helped me immensely to understand where this all began. He helps me in his book, The Powers That Be, to see that for about 8,000 years we have been programmed to think in these moralistic judgments, to continue to have justice based on these judgments, which imply that if people are judged one way, they deserve to suffer and be punished. If they're judged another way, they deserve to be rewarded. There is another way, and I'm glad that we'll have a chance to explore this as we go along. This other way being, let's not judge each other right or wrong. Let's connect in a way in which we continue to enjoy contributing to one another's well-being. Now, I'd like to outline for you some other ways in which we have been educated to communicate and influencing each other that I'm sad about, that I think contribute to great pain. Another one is making comparisons between ourselves and other people. Dan Greenberg, in his book, How to Make Yourself Miserable, demonstrates through humor the insidious power that comparative thinking can have over us. He suggests that if readers have a sincere desire to make life miserable for themselves, they might learn to compare themselves to other people. For those unfamiliar with this practice, he provides a few exercises. The first one displays pictures of a man and a woman who embody ideal physical beauty by contemporary media standards. Readers are instructed to take their own body measurements, compare them to those superimposed on the pictures of the attractive specimens, and dwell on the differences. This exercise produces what it promises. We start to feel miserable as we engage in these comparisons. By the time we're as depressed as we think possible, we turn the page to discover that this first exercise, getting us to compare ourselves physically, was a mere warm-up. Since physical beauty is relatively superficial, Greenberg now provides an opportunity to compare ourselves on things that matter more, such as achievement. He resorts to the phone book to give readers a few random individuals to compare themselves with. The first name he claims to have pulled out of the phone book is Wolfgang Mozart. Greenberg lists the languages Mozart spoke and the major pieces he had composed by the time he was a teenager. The exercise then instructs readers to recall their own achievements at their current stage of life, and then compare them with what Mozart had accomplished by age 12, and to dwell on the differences. Even readers who never emerge from the self-induced misery of this exercise might see how powerfully this type of thinking blocks compassion, both for ourselves and others. Another kind of communication that disconnects us from life and contributes to great suffering is the denial of responsibility. Such communication clouds our awareness that we are each responsible for our own thoughts, feelings, and actions. The use of the common expression "have to," as in there are some things you have to do, whether you like it or not, illustrates how personal responsibility for our actions is obscured in such speech. Or the phrase "makes one feel," as in "you make me feel guilty," is another example of how language facilitates the denial of personal responsibility for our own feelings and thoughts. So to make sure that I am making clear what I mean by needs and not other forms of communication, I'd like to say a few sentences and have you think about whether you consider it a need or not, and then I'll give you my impression. Sentence 1. You irritate me when you leave company documents on the conference room floor. I would not hear a need in this. I'm sure there's one behind it, but I don't hear the need clearly expressed. I hear the person simply blaming the other person for their feelings and not attributing their feelings to their needs. Number 2. I feel angry when you say that. My need for respect wasn't met. In this case, I do hear a need being expressed. Number 3. I feel frustrated when you come late. I don't hear a need here. I would have liked to have had the frustration followed with the words, "because I'm needing." Number 4. I'm sad that you won't be coming for dinner because I was hoping we could spend the evening together. I don't hear a need being expressed here. I hear the person saying that they're sad, and I hear that they were hoping to spend the evening together, but spending an evening together is a strategy. I didn't hear the need that would be met. I would have preferred that it be expressed this way. I'm sad that you won't be coming home for dinner tonight, because my need is very strong right now for some connection and intimacy. Number 5. I feel disappointed because you said you would do it and you didn't. Here again, notice that after the word "because" was the word "you," not "I." This doesn't accept responsibility for our feelings by attributing our feelings to our needs. Number 6. I'm discouraged because I would have liked to have progressed further in my work by now. I would call this a need, not directly expressed, but it gets at that I have a need for some development that isn't being met. Number 7. Little things people say sometimes hurt me. I don't hear the needs here. I hear the person attributing responsibility for their feelings to what others say. Number 8. I feel happy that you received that reward. Here again, the person's attributing their feelings to something that happened outside of themselves. I would have preferred they would have said the need that contributed to their happiness that was met by the other person receiving that award. Number 9. I feel scared when you raise your voice that way. Once again, The person doesn't follow their feelings with their needs. They attribute their feelings to the other person's actions. Number 10. I'm grateful that you offered me a ride because I was really needing support in getting what I had ready for my party this evening. I do hear the person expressing their need for support, and that's why they feel the gratitude. The thing that people seem to have the most trouble with is to differentiate needs from requests. I said a few minutes ago, the difference is that a request is a reference to a specific person taking a specific action that we hope will meet our needs. By contrast, needs contain no reference to specific people taking specific actions. Instead, they refer to the life within us that is being fulfilled or not fulfilled, the needs within. And I said that all human beings have the same needs. Now, sadly, we have often been educated to mix up these two, so we think we have needs that are really not needs. They're culturally learned states that the culture might want us to have. So we don't have a need for a certain kind of car. But we can be educated to think we do need a big car. We don't have a need for status. But we have been educated to mix that up with a need, and we're not really clear what is the need behind these things. So we will be working at how to get the difference between these two things, between needs and clear request for getting the needs met. But more than the expression of the need, I hope I've made clear how important it is that we see the need as life in action within us. It's a precious gift to reveal the very life within us to other people. So let's look then at what the process of fully expressing our anger actually requires in concrete form. The first step is to stop and do nothing. Just take a breath. We refrain from making any move to blame or punish the other person. We simply stay quiet. Then we identify the thoughts that are making us angry. For example, we overhear a statement that leads us to believe that we've been excluded from a conversation because of race. We sense anger, stop, and recognize the thoughts stirring in our head. We see that we're saying, "It's unfair to act like that. She's being racist." And we know that all such judgments like this are tragic expressions of our needs. So we take the next step and connect to the needs behind those judgments. If I judge someone to be racist, the need might be for inclusion, equality, respect, connection. To fully express ourselves, we now open our mouths. But what comes out is not the anger and the judgments that cause the anger. Now we're connected to life. What comes out is what needs of ours have not been met. And anger is no longer the feeling, because when we're connected to our needs, we feel other feelings than anger. We might feel frustrated, powerless, sad, but never angry. To articulate these feelings, however, may require a lot of courage. For me, it's easy to get angry and tell people that was a racist thing to do. In fact, I may even enjoy saying such things, but to get down to the deeper feelings and needs behind such a statement may be very frightening. So to fully express what's going on in us, we don't stop at the anger and express that or express the judgments that we have. To fully express ourselves, we might say, "When you entered the room and started talking to the others and didn't talk to me, and then you made the comment about white people that you did, I felt really hurt and sad. I also got scared. It triggered off my need to be treated equally. I'd like you to tell me how you feel when I tell you this. When I come out of that kind of energy, the energy of being in touch with my feelings and needs, the other person and I are both more likely to get our needs met.